Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Hello and welcome to a brand new Arsblog Arscast right here on arsblog.com. How are you? Hope you're well. Hope you and yours are well, safe, healthy, doing okay, etc., etc. Here we are, another Friday, another podcast, another week is gone, another week of lockdown, another week of stories and news, and another week in which we're still none the wiser about lots of stuff, least of all football. Even if there has been some sort of clarity from other parts of Europe, we saw the news from France, for example, that the Prime Minister there said that no sport, no mass gatherings can take place until September, which has effectively brought an end to professional football, the seasons anyway, in Ligue 1 and Ligue 2. And from what we see, PSG have been confirmed champions, and they've decided promotion and relegation. In some cases, it's probably more cut and dry than in others, but it strikes me that potentially with so many games left to play, despite the fact this is an unprecedented pandemic, etc., etc., there is room for legal action if you're on the wrong end of a decision, which means you'll be playing football in a lower division. And the idea of them trying something like that in England, because of the money that's at stake, the difference between the Premier League and the difference between the Championship and all the money that's involved in the Premier League, I just don't know how they can make any of those decisions. Like, if they decide to give Liverpool the title, which, you know, is an inevitability, if football continues, Liverpool are going to be champions, and deservedly so. They've won so many games, they've so many points. But right at the bottom, how do you tell teams who could potentially escape relegation? And we've seen it happen before. Remember the year West Ham somehow did it, and other Portsmouth maybe one year, when it looked like for sure they were going down, but put together these runs to stay in the Premier League and maintain the income and all those millions of pounds, you know. They might argue that it's not unprecedented for a team to drag itself out of the depths and somehow survive. So I don't know how they're going to be able to do that if that's the road they go down in England. But we heard about Project Restart as well, that the Premier League are in discussions about how to get football going again. And the Premier League Director of Football has issued a document to all clubs saying that these are the guidelines that are going to be in place. So there's going to be testing for all players and officials 48 hours before returning to training. All footballs and stuff like that is going to be disinfected. All staff have to wear PPE, which, you know, how do you justify that? How do you justify football club staff wearing PPE when some hospitals and care homes and nursing homes can't get it? How do you do that? Players have got to wear a snood or a mask at all times. I mean, how do you train properly wearing a face mask, even if it's a light one? How do you train properly wearing a snood? Is it hygienic? Who washes your snood? What do you do with it? Is there going to be a snood dump? Are they going to build a hole in which to throw all these snoods? Is it going to be like a radioactive dump of snoods? I don't know how they're going to do this. There's another thing. Players and staff will be banned from spitting at the training ground. I mean, how on earth do you enforce that? I mean, you can tell players it would be better if you didn't spit, but, you know, has anyone watched football ever? What do footballers do? They run, they jump, they kick a football, and they spit, and they do snot rockets. Like, maybe they don't have to. Maybe it's habit or something, but, you know, I don't know what's the punishment if you see a player spitting. I mean, what do you do? Do you, like, have to disinfect the pitch? Does the player get sent home? Does he get 100 lines? I must not spit on the training ground. seems weird. But look, it's, you know, it's not abnormal for a big business to have discussions about how they get their business back up and running again. I think, you know, football is not the only business that will be having these kind of talks and making these kind of plans. It's just how sensible they are and how enforceable they are and everything else. A little bit later on, I'm going to be talking to Nigel Mitchell, who you will know, many of you will know, of course, as the pitch side man at Arsenal. He does the interviews and does the bits and pieces at halftime, but of course also does stuff for the club's official channels, podcasts and videos and all that kind of stuff. So we're going to talk to him later on about what's, you know, what's a typical match day for him and what it's like working for the club and being in the position that he's in and doing the work that he does. So hopefully you'll enjoy that. He is our second guest on the show today. He is our second Nigel. Our first Nigel is a different one. This week, the Arsenal Supporters Trust released a report which predicted that Arsenal could register a £19 million loss for the year to the end of May if the rest of the current campaign is played behind closed doors. As yet, we don't know when football is coming back. Beyond that, if next season is played behind closed doors, the impact on Arsenal could be massive, with losses hitting somewhere in the region of £144 million, which would be catastrophic even for a club owned by a billionaire. And there are wider implications, of course, for football as a whole. With me to discuss that is Arsenal Supporters Trust member Nigel Phillips. Hi, Nigel.
Afternoon, Andrew.
Can you just sort of outline the broad scope of this report that you've put together? Because we published a bit on Arsblog News and there were people saying, well, how can you publish this? You don't know what's going to happen. Nobody knows what's going to happen. But would it be fair to say that, that Arsenal and many other businesses have to try and predict what the financial impact of this crisis is going to be, even without all the full information?
Absolutely. The scenario planning which is going on by all clubs at the moment at every level, from Premier League down to National League and senior non-league, is significant. And that's why people just took those early decisions around furlough, which have been turned back, and the various other measures that people have taken. But we can't underestimate how massive this impact will be on football and Arsenal, not just for now, but for the longer term. In terms of the credibility of the numbers, Arsenal's financial year end is the 31st of May. So we were so close to reaching that period with a high degree of certainty. We would have known what the figures are by, let's say, the middle of March. And then by that stage, you've only got April and May to run. So our estimate in the column, which assumes, and this is obviously a fact now, that the remaining 10 league games for Arsenal will not be played in front of crowds. We don't know whether they'll be played at all, but if they are played, they will be behind closed doors. So the estimates we've had to make are around the three revenue streams that the club have, which are gate receipts, it's broadcast, and then it's commercial and retail. So by tweaking the numbers, Andrew, we're able to come up with what we believe is a fairly robust figure for the end of May 2020.
So the idea that next season, if and when it happens, or, you know, whenever it might happen, could be played entirely behind closed doors, I think we can all see the impact that would have, because all those revenue streams will be badly affected. There are implications, you know, for match day revenue, for season tickets. You know, the season ticket, I think season ticket renewals are up at the end of May. That would be a massive amount of money that Arsenal were expecting to bring in. As it stands, they may well have to put money out to refund season ticket holders who aren't getting the games that they paid for.
Yeah, you make some good points there, Andrew. The prospect of a whole season behind closed doors is, for a club like Arsenal, who have done all that work for the new stadium, for the size of the stadium. We've got 9,000 premium seats of the club, whether that be club executive box, Diamond Club, everything associated with that was about match day income. Pretty much as we see up in N17, it's a very high business model towards what they achieve on a match day. If you were to completely wipe that out for a club like Arsenal, that takes somewhere around about £90 million out of your revenue for a season. Mm. And Arsenal's reliance on gate money, which is 25% of total revenues, doesn't seem a lot when you compare it with Bournemouth, who, you know, they have an average crowd of about 10,500. Virtually everything they get is TV money. But a whole season behind closed doors would mean significant impacts to the club in terms of the money we spend, because the club has been operated on a self-sustaining basis for many, many years. So what do you do with your payroll, which is your number one outgoing? Mm. And you touched on the very valid point there about season ticket money in advance for the next season. So gold members, so that's general admission season tickets, their renewal date is normally 31st of May 2020 for the 2021 season. The platinum, so that's club level and boxes, they go even before the gold members. So when everyone talks about the, you know, Arsenal have a lot of cash, that cash figure is a one-day figure on the 31st of May at the end of every season. And there's a huge amount of that figure is money in advance for the next season. And that money in advance can somewhere be between 60 and 70 million pounds. And what do Arsenal do with that 60 to 70 million pounds when they've got it up front? Well, during June, July, and the first half of August, very little revenue's coming in. And Arsenal have a cash burn, a monthly spend of somewhere between 27 and 28 million pounds. So if you said there was no income coming in and you had June and July to pay, you could have 55, 56 million pounds to go out there. That cash flow comes from the season ticket money, which we've all ponied up before the 31st of May. So just on a short-term basis, you see that there's a cash flow squeeze going on as well.
Speaking of the cash reserves, it's one of those things that people talk about quite a lot. And Arsenal, you know, famously have had significant cash reserves down the years, and the numbers have fluctuated, of course. But isn't there part of, obviously part of that is used for operations, for keeping things going, as you said. But there are also other outgoings, and there's a need to keep cash in the bank to service loans and the stadium and those kind of things as well.
You're following it well there, Andrew. So this is the famous debt service reserve account, which when the Arsenal put the debt in place for the Emirates Stadium, which initially was £260 million, and we're now down to about £160 million, the people who lent that money, and this was once the stadium had been completed and there's revenue streams and you can see what's going on, you can make predictions. The people who lend that money, long-term money, because you know, some of this money goes out until 2031. We've got another 11 years on a chunk of it. They need certain security to ensure that if football performance drops off, if you don't qualify for Europe, heaven forbid there's a relegation, that they need to know that there's money there to service their debt when revenue streams aren't as expected. Mm. So there's always this money which is locked up in this debt service reserve account, and it's about £36 million. Not good because you can't use it, but in times like now, it is good because that will service the stadium debt for about 18 months. So you're supposed to keep it topped up. So you're supposed to, if you use some from that, you're supposed to keep it up to this level.
Yeah.
But it's exactly for times like this that you have that debt service reserve account. So that's the first amount which is always got to be taken off because that's not freely available. And then you've got your general debt service because that's in an account. And then you've got the money that you're paying as you're going along. The other big unknown that people seem to ignore or don't want to believe exists is the money that we owe on players.
Yeah.
And, you know, over the last three summers, Arsenal have not been shy in the transfer market. I mean, you can go through a dozen players and come up with 300 million of money spent. We haven't received so much in. And like a prudent club, you don't pay it all up front. you stagger it, you pay it, you string it out for as long as you can. So Arsenal still have money owing on players somewhere between, and we don't know this exactly, but you look at the accounts and you look at the debtors and creditors and provisions for payments and all the rest of it. It's circa £120 million owing on players. Not all in 1 year, but there will be money owed, and it's predominantly to overseas clubs. I mean, the only UK player who's come in is Tierney.
Mm.
And I would imagine that if you sign someone in the summer of 2019, you make a down payment. And last summer, which had Pepe, Saliba and Tierney coming in, the net spend Arsenal had was £93 million. So we've estimated that they probably spent up front maybe 20, 25 million of that, leaving another sort of 70-ish to be spread out over a number of years. But then you've got to add that on top of what's already there for Luiz and Torreira and Leno and Socrates and Guendouzi, etc., etc. So there's a big chunk which is coming out of there as well, which, let's say it's paid on contract period, which is player contracts run to the 30th of June. Some of that money owed would come from season ticket money, which is not coming in this summer. So once again, we've got another outflow with nothing coming in to balance it.
Yeah, I mean, look, I think that's going to be an issue for football in general as football clubs look to cut costs and look at, their revenue streams just disappearing overnight. The money that football clubs owe to each other, the money that football clubs owe to agents as well. The Premier League, I think last year around the start of April, they listed the Premier League clubs' payments to agents, how much each club paid to agents for their transfer dealings. I think Liverpool were top that year because they paid a lot for some players. They haven't yet released those figures, which is quite interesting, but that's another aspect of outgoings that people don't necessarily think about.
Well, let me just jump in there, Andrew. So for the period you're talking about, which was essentially the 18-19 transfer to window, Liverpool were top of that league, £44 million out to agents.
Yeah.
Arsenal, you know, it mirrors pretty much where you are in the league. We were eighth in that league at £11.2 million paid to agents. We have been anxiously awaiting the release of the current figures, which last year came out the first week of April.
Yeah.
This year they haven't come out. We are predicting, because of Pepe and David Luiz, that Arsenal will have come up that table and will be significantly higher than eighth and significantly higher than 11 million.
Mm. Whether that's the involvement of big super agents like George Mendes and Kia Jurabchian, I guess we can only speculate, but certainly it will be interesting.
Speculate very well there, Andrew.
We'll wait and see those figures. So, you know, look, this is a difficult situation. And again, it's worth pointing out that Arsenal are not the only club who are going to face situations and financial issues like this. But, you know, as this is an Arsenal website, an Arsenal podcast, that is what we are focusing on. One of the stories that's been doing the rounds is player cuts or player wage cuts. And we understand that the majority of the squad have agreed a 12.5% pay cut. The contractual side of that has still to be put in place, I think, although they were hoping to have those signatures in order to push through those cuts this month so they could start straight away. What does that save Arsenal on a monthly basis? And would it be reasonable to suggest that if things continue the way we think they are going to continue with no football, or certainly if football comes back, it's going to be behind closed doors at some point in the future, that this might just be the first round of cuts for players and the wage bill?
The Arsenal wage bill, all up, is about £20 million a month. And that covers something like 725 employees and about 1,000 casual match day staff.
Mm.
We estimate that, and this is a conservative estimate, that 80% of that wage spend goes to the first team squad. We have 72 registered professional players, so that will be from 18 upwards. But we're estimating of our 27 player first team squad, they take 80% of that. So that's about 16 million. The protracted negotiations around wage cuts or deferrals or whatever you want to call it, and this is in conjunction with the executive team, which encapsulates 14 people from Vinay to Rao to Mark Ganella, the legal team. All told, they're taking a 30% for 12 months. The players are, the majority of players are doing 12.5%. Of that 20 million wage spend a month, that will save £2.5 million. So I don't want to be disrespectful, but it's the tiniest of haircuts you could possibly imagine.
Yeah.
And the aggravation or the angst it will have caused by bringing your first team manager in there to negotiate with players about trying to do the right thing. I mean, is it worth it? But, you know, we would have to do another one. And if you're sitting there and you've got 12 months of a contract to go and you're potentially going to go to another club, you're thinking, I'm a millionaire and this club is owned by a billionaire.
Mm.
Who's doing who the favour? Who's subsidising who here? If we were community owned, if it was a, you know, trust run club or something like that, and you could see exactly where it's going, I can see a lot more of the moral persuasion for it. But, you know, it's the right thing to do. But does it move the dial at all?
Mm.
It's very minor, Andrew, and I'm sure it will have caused a lot of angst and relationship damage if anyone cares about that.
Yeah, I mean, look, we're being told that it's all been done, you know, quite amicably and everything else, but, you know, I think I made the point a few times that, when you're talking money to anybody, whether, you know, whatever business you're in, whatever your job is, if someone comes in and starts, you know, putting pressure on you to take a pay cut, whether you can see a good reason for it or not, it still doesn't, it's not the best news you can get, and it might colour your view of the company or colour your view of colleagues or anything else. But, you know, that's something that might come out in the wash, and hopefully, fingers crossed, the fallout from that isn't too damaging, because, you know, at some point we need to get everybody back together and to be a team and to be united and harmonious and all of those things on the pitch, because those things make a difference. But it brings us nicely to KSE and Stan Kroenke, and one of the other stories that's been doing the rounds is this cash, I have this in inverted commas, a cash injection from KSE. What's your understanding of exactly what that is? Because it seems counterintuitive that if Stan Kroenke is coming and saying, look, here's a load of money for Arsenal to use to help us through this difficult period, you know, at the same time, you don't take £2.5 million off the wage bill every month if the guy is coming in and giving you a load of money to tide things over. So what is your understanding of what this cash injection, if you like, from KSE actually is?
Well, I think first of all, I like your inverted commas, but I think you need to move the opening ones slightly to the left, because there was a word in front of cash injection, which is in my inverted commas, which said massive cash injection.
Right.
and the journalist who reported that, it's not been corrected by the club or anything. Why should they correct it? No, there's been no massive cash injection. The first thing Arsenal will have done is they've got an overdraft facility. It's less than 12 months. It's never been utilised. It's £50 million. So that's available to draw. All the conditions precedent to use that facility is available. So the first port of call, once your cash is exhausted, is to use that debt facility of £50 million. That can tie things over for 2 months. What I do suspect that KSE have done, they would have been brought into discussions with various creditors of Arsenal, and the only creditors are the bondholders, the debenture holders, who are, you know, 5,000 or 6,000 individuals who own the debentures for the stadium, and Barclays, is to confirm that he stands behind the business plan and what's going on. And how he's done that? Has he provided a guarantee to these people? Well, at the moment, as far as I'm aware, we haven't gone to the people to relax any of the covenants, to borrow additional money, etc., etc. But I'm absolutely sure that, I mean, this is an asset that Kroenke, less than 2 years ago, spent an extra £550 million so he can get 100% control of it. So the thought that he would do anything or not do anything which would severely impair the value of his one of his trophy assets is hard to contemplate. So I'm absolutely sure that he is there, KSE is there in the background to do whatever is needed, but it's too early to say it's massive cash injection. If we go all next season with no games with spectators, and we're looking at a 90 million reduction just in gate receipts, and we're fully maxed out on our loans, then he may have to step in. And there's several ways he can do that. He himself can put a loan into the club. All the Chelsea money is owed to Abramovich. It's not equity. It's not turned into shares in the club. It's a repayable loan. So he could make a loan facility available. He could permanently put money in by increasing the capital. Highly unlikely, but he could say, here's an extra 100 million, recapitalize and get on with that. Or he could bring in a third party investor. He could say, you know, do I need 100%? The Glazers don't have 100% of United, they have about 90%. Could I bring someone in for 10%? It's hard to imagine why anyone would want 10%, because it gives you nothing in terms of control or voting. I mean, look at the way Usmanov was frozen out for all those years. So there are things, but absolutely, this is a key asset. And I hate to talk about Arsenal as an asset and all this type of stuff, because it is so emotional to so many people. But he will be looking at, we know he's a financial investor, so he will be doing whatever is needed to keep the ship afloat.
It says something, though, doesn't it, about the way that football is run? And look, nobody could have predicted this kind of scenario. I don't think the prospect of a worldwide pandemic, which is seeing thousands of people die and everything shut down, was in anybody's mind, you know, beyond scriptwriters for movies and things like that. It just, you know, it just seemed impossible for something like that to happen. So it's very difficult to future plan for it or anything like it. But you're talking about how if Arsenal run through their cash reserves, which could happen if we go through the summer without season ticket income, potentially, you know, without some of the broadcast revenue, because I guess that's an issue between the clubs and the rights holders, that if the games don't take place for some reason, there might be some debate or discussion over what money is to be paid. And then we dip into the fine into the overdraft facility that you talk about of around £50 million, which could keep us going for around 2 months. The finances in football are so precarious, and I know it's probably not unique to football. You know, cash flow and revenues and all those kind of things are operate that way with many businesses. But a lot of football clubs, and not just Arsenal, could find themselves in real trouble very quickly.
Absolutely, there's very very few immune to this. You could probably take out the one or two who are owned by countries, sovereign wealth funds, so you can't see any material impact for someone like Manchester City, who are owned by Abu Dhabi. I mean, what Abramovich will do with Chelsea, I mean, everyone's got speculated about what his plans. I don't think he's seen a game this season. And then just run it down the table, run it down the divisions, and every club is, it's not hand to mouth, but there's no one sitting there immune from what is potentially a massive shakeout here, Andrew.
Well, I don't quite know what more we can say about this other than it is going to be a massive financial challenge on top of all the other challenges that this thing is providing us with. I mean, just finally, your thoughts on what it might mean for football, for football club ownership, for fandom, because we've all grown with football over the last number of years from clubs which were, I guess, essentially community-based, to being these big worldwide organizations supported by fans across the world. And we know Arsenal have an amazing fan base all over the world. Is it going to have an impact on the game in terms of how it returns and what we might see football becoming as, I hate to say football as a product, but that's kind of what it has been. You know, it's been sold everywhere to everyone for as high a price as possible, and we've all played our part in that and everything else. But do you think that the far side of this, it might be something that changes?
I think there's got to be change, Andrew. I think if there is any silver lining in this, I think it's going to be over the next few months, when we watch games behind closed doors, you'll see how anodyne that experience is. And it will remind people that match attending supporters, whether they be home or away fans, are an integral part in the overall product. Don't like the word product, but you know what I mean. So fans, if they can get organised, will have a very big say in how things come back, because football without fans will be nothing. Doesn't matter whether you've got 2,000 fans at Dulwich Hamlet or 60,000 fans at Arsenal, whatever. It's the supporters that make the whole thing. There's got to be a reality check around the percentage of your earnings which get paid out to players.
So, yeah, I was going to ask you, I mean, do you think it could precipitate a salary cap in football, which is something that seemed kind of unthinkable?
Well, if we talk about the Premier League on its own, and it's difficult to do this because the Premier League 20 is a global marketplace, but the way the ownership is going, it won't take long to have enough owners in there who are financial investors. financial investors who would love to have a salary cap in there. They're absolutely begging for one to be put in place. But why would Man City go for a salary cap? If Newcastle get bought by the Saudis, why would they want a salary cap? They just want to, you know, this is what financial fair play was brought in to do. And it's likely that financial fair play will be relaxed in the coming periods to allow people to right-size their businesses or whatever. So some sort of reality around wages. I mean, I think the transfer market and figures we've seen in the past for, you know, good but averagey type of players will absolutely get rebased. That there may still be one or two, you know, stellar type of contracts for the very, very top players, but the number of clubs who will be able to participate in that will severely be reduced. And it's going to take a time. And when we do get back, what's the economic impact on people's ability to pay for their subscriptions, to go to the pay for the season tickets, etc., etc.? And then, are people comfortable to go back into a stadium where there's almost 60,000 people? Liverpool have put their expansion from 54,000 to 61,000 on hold, not because they're worried about there won't be the people. I mean, that's the situation of where we are and construction and everything else. And how long will it be before people are comfortable to come back into that very intimate environment of a stadium when we're not worried about
the contact with people? Yeah, and just finally, you mentioned transfers there. And I think that's one of the things that, you know, over the years, we get to summertime and everyone's like, transfers, what are we going to do? How much are we going to spend? You know, who's going here? Who's going there? You know, when you outline the figures that you've outlined and the potential financial impact of this, and again, this is sort of just prediction. It's not necessarily saying this is fact, but if this happens, then, you know, the impact will be quite severe on Arsenal. The idea that as a football club, we are going to go out and spend a lot of money on new players seems absolutely absurd.
In which period? Are we talking about summer 20 or ever again?
Yeah, well, maybe ever again, but certainly the next time whatever the transfer market is open, if Arsenal are looking to KSE to take overdrafts to keep things running, it doesn't seem likely that we're going to go out and spend the equivalent of that overdraft on a centre half.
It somehow defeats the mantra of being self-sustaining, and unless there is some sort of miraculous change in the thought process of the financial investor who is our owner, then you're absolutely spot on. It won't be happening. We will have to manage with what we've got, which might be a great thing for the youth coming through.
That's it.
And if you've got great belief in some of those players we want to see more of, maybe the investment we've had in that academy for, you know, it's had several sort of iterations, but if we believe there's a decent stock in there, then maybe that's the way you'll have to rebuild.
Well, look, I think everybody is going to have to find new and inventive ways of squad building, and whether that's, you know, building from youth, whether that's extending the contracts of players that perhaps you might have had to or wanted to sell simply because it's easier to do that, or otherwise we'll have to wait and see. But look, Nigel, thank you very much indeed for your time, and thank you for going through those figures with us. You know, it is a reality that Arsenal and football and many all football clubs, professional football clubs, are going to have to deal with this. So we'll wait and see what happens. But Nigel, we'll leave it there. Thank you very much indeed for being with us.
Thanks, Andrew.
The full report is available to members of the Arsenal Supporters Trust. You can find their website at arsenaltrust.org. That is arsenaltrust.org. And this week they did a Q&A with David Ornstein of The Athletic. They usually do these meetings, you know, in person. Obviously, there's a crowd and a guest and what have you. But because of what's going on, this was done digitally over Zoom. But if you want to find out more about that, if you want to find out more about the finances and the rest, just visit the website arsenaltrust.org.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
It's a brand new year, and what better time to get going with that online store you've been thinking of? Those "I was there when Arsenal actually scored a goal" t-shirts would fly off the shelves right now. And to get yourself up and running, you need Shopify. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real life store stage, all the way through to the did we hit a million orders stage, Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout, up to 36% better compared to other leading commerce platforms, and sell more with less effort with thanks to Shopify Magic, your AI-powered all-star. Sign up for a $1 a month trial period at shopify.com/arsblog, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/arsblog now to grow your business no matter what stage you're in. shopify.com/arsblog. Right, joining me now on the Arscast, I'm delighted to welcome somebody whose voice I'm sure many of you will know from his work with Arsenal Media, hosting the Arsenal World Show and Arsenal Podcasts, but also pitch side at Arsenal. It's Nigel Mitchell. Hello, Nigel.
Hi, Andrew. How are you doing?
I'm good. How are you? How are you getting on?
Well, I'm all right. Obviously, I'm not doing any work at the moment, so it's a bit quiet. But getting through everything, and I can't complain, really. You know, we're just being asked to stay at home and stay safe, aren't we? Really, and I'm very fortunate. I live near some parks, so I can go and get my daily exercise in a nice environment, and then I just sort of spend the rest of the day sort of reading or watching TV and stuff like that, and then sure. You know. then the next day begins.
Yes.
So hopefully we'll be back to some football very soon. And it's nice to catch up with some old matches. I notice Arsenal have been putting out the Arsenal Reloaded shows. So they're really nice to watch on a Wednesday afternoon or now Wednesday evening, just to get some football action.
Yeah.
But yeah, like everyone, I'm really missing it, you know.
For sure. I mean, look, your involvement with the club and with the match day experience is obviously quite unique. And we'll come to that because I'm curious about, you know, the work itself and everything else. But, you know, as somebody who has a background in radio myself, I'm always really interested in talking to people who do radio and who have done radio. And your bio says, you know, you're a TV presenter, radio presenter and voiceover artist. And, you know, I do a bit of that myself. So, you know, how did you decide that this was the business to be in? Was it one thing in particular that drove you to it? Was it a need to perform or how did you end up being a TV radio presenter?
Well, from a very early age, I was actually 6 years old. And I remember exactly the moment because we were on our way to school one day and my mum had just passed her driving test so that she could take us to school. And she hated any noise in the car. She was a very nervous driver. And so she said, no talking, no radio, nothing. So we just used to drive to school in absolute silence. And then one day, I can't remember why, my dad ended up taking us instead. And he turned the car on and the radio came on. And I went, oh, why have you got that on? And he went, oh, well, we were listening to Kid yesterday because he's just started, he's just moved from Radio 1 to Capital. Now, Kid is obviously David Jensen. You may remember, legendary DJ.
Sure.
From Radio 1 and Capital and many other stations down the years. And Mum and Dad were very good friends with him. They actually used to live across the road from us.
Wow.
Kid and Gudrun Jensen. And I went to school with their kids down the years. And so Mum and Dad were very good friends. They wanted to hear what he was like on Capital because it was a big change for him moving from Radio 1. And so anyway, Dad went, well, I'll turn it off. And I went, no, leave it on. And it was this guy called Graham Dean who was doing the breakfast show on Capital back then. And that was the first time I sort of remember hearing the radio. And in that 20 minutes on the way to school that morning back in, I think, 1986 or something like that, I kind of went, wow, this guy's getting paid to play records and talk. I want to do that. So I remember sort of that night stealing a load of my mum and dad's cassettes and their cassette recorder and going upstairs to my bedroom and pretending I was Graham Dean on Capital Radio. My love of it just grew from that. And then after a few months, I kind of thought, well, I can be Nigel Mitchell now.
Okay,
so I sort of started being myself and just used to practice, used to really annoy my family, sort of doing shows from my bedroom to the whole house, you know, going, listen to this, recording jingles off the radio and things like that and pretending to be on air, really. So I was sort of practicing from the age of six. And I just thought this is an amazing thing to do. And I was very lucky through Kid. I got to go up to Capital a few times when it was at the Euston Tower and meet some legendary DJs. And that sort of made me go, wow, this is just amazing.
Yeah.
So whilst all my friends were sort of going, well, I want to be a doctor. You know, the teacher used to go around at school going, what does everyone want to be when they grow up? And everyone would be, oh, I want to be a lawyer. I want to be a doctor. I want to do this. And I was like, I want to be a DJ. And everyone used to laugh.
I mean, that's the thing. I mean, people, you know, I know people have their passions, but I think there's something quite unique about radio that if it gets its hooks into you and if you become obsessed with it, it's a really difficult thing not to get rid of. You know, you're sort of really focused on doing it. This is what I want to do. And it was all I wanted to do as a kid, as a teenager anyway. It was either be a footballer or it was be a radio DJ. And, you know, beer and stuff got in the way of my football, which isn't to say that I ever thought I was going to be, you know, turning out at Highbury or anything like that. But you know, the radio thing has always been an obsession. It remains that to this day. Like, do you ever watch a TV show or a movie and they have a radio studio in and you go, hey, wait a minute, that's the wrong microphone. Or why aren't you wearing headphones? Why aren't you wearing headphones? This is ridiculous.
I'm a big Alan Partridge fan.
Yeah.
And that used to wind me up a lot because when he started doing his series where he was in the radio studio, some of the links he'd be wearing headphones and some of the links he wouldn't be wearing headphones. And I'd be going, well, he'd be getting terrible feedback.
Yeah. Yeah, nothing.
So,
So who were the DJs on Capital at the time that sort of caught your imagination?
So it would have been Graham Dean initially and David Jensen because of obviously the connection with mum and dad. And then it was at the time of Pat Sharp and Mick Brown, Chris Tarrant as well. I loved listening to his breakfast show when he took over doing that show. And those guys just sort of, it just sounded, Capital back then just sounded huge. You know, it was the station to listen to in London. It felt to me like it owned London. If there was something going on, Capital owned it, you know, and it just had a massive sound. And they used to, you know, I always remember the first time I went up to the Euston Tower, and I'd listened to Neil Fox had this, Dr. Fox, as he was known, had the jukebox, and the jingle went, "This is Earth's most powerful instant music machine." And obviously nowadays you just type into iTunes or whatever, or Spotify, and the tune comes up immediately. But back then you had to go into a record library. If someone said, "Oh, can you play this record?" Someone had run down to the record library, go and get it, bring it back up and stick it on.
Yeah.
But he had this jukebox, this most amazing instant music machine. I was like, how on earth does this work? And I never forget when I walked into that studio and I saw a detached keyboard and a part of me just died. I was like, oh.
It's like it's pre-prepared somehow.
Yeah, that was pre-prepared. And it said on it, it did actually say Dr. Fox's new improved jukebox or something. And it was a detached keyboard, because on air, the beauty of radio, the theatre of the mind, he used to just bash the keys. Yeah. And you'd think, oh my God, he's getting this song, which of course nowadays is totally possible.
Yeah, not back then, though, when you were dealing with 7-inch singles and
also,
carts.
You know, they always used to say, "We're broadcasting from the top of the Euston Tower," or the Mighty Power Tower, and you'd go up this amazing staircase in the Euston Tower, and you'd only go to the first floor. So you go, hang on a minute, I'm sure I haven't gone up 30 flights, and it was all on the first floor. But they used to, that theater was amazing.
But that's,
you know?
It's the thing about the, you know, it's completely different nowadays, because radio stations all have TV cameras in them, or most of them anyway, and radio stations have websites, you know, with pictures of all the presenters and the schedules and everything else. But back in the day, you know, you would hear a voice on the radio, and unless that person was a very famous DJ and appearing on Top of the Pops, you really had no way of knowing what they looked like. So you'd sort of create this image of the voice, the person behind the voice, and of course, DJ voices being DJ voices, as you know, you're sort of thinking, well, this is a tall, strapping man with, you know, long flowing locks. And then when eventually you might see a picture of them 3 years later, it's like this small bald guy wearing glasses. You're like, what the fuck?
What the hell? So I remember that, because that Sunday I went up to the network chart, and I've still got the script, the Nescafe network chart in 1988, the day that Kylie Minogue and I Should Be So Lucky was number one.
What a time
and,
to be alive.
I remember sitting in the studio going, this is amazing. And I turned to my dad and went, I know the number one before anyone. This is incredible. And I've still got that script in my little studio at home. That was the day that I met Mick and Pat for the first time. And obviously I knew what Pat Sharp looked like because of Funhouse. So Funhouse, I think, had been around for a little while. So, you know, I knew what Pat looked like. Had no idea what Mick looked like. And I remember meeting Mick Brown and going, what? Because the voice just didn't match, you know, the image I had in my head. I love radio, and I fell out of love with it a little while ago. But I'm slowly getting, I miss it now. I haven't done it for a few years.
What was it? The sort of formulaic nature of it?
Yeah, and I've been very fortunate. The kind of radio I've been allowed to do down the years has, I've been allowed a lot of freedom. And I think that's through my TV background. And then the way I got into radio was via TV, via Disney, and a station called Capital Disney, which was sort of, you know, Capital and Disney came together to create this children's radio station. And I was very much allowed freedom. I could make my own jingles. I could make my own features. There was a playlist, but if I thought that song, a certain song fitted better at the top of the hour, I was allowed to change it. So I was very much programming and producing my own show. Mm. And it was great. You know, it was brilliant. And it was at Capitol. I mean, they'd moved to Leicester Square by that point, but there were still those amazing faces around. And, you know, you'd walk into the studio and down, and then people like, you know, Greg Edwards, who was this legendary soul DJ, would walk past and you go, "Oh, it's Greg Edwards." Mm. And Simon Bates, who was on Classic at that time. And, you know, all these people, all these legends who you'd grown up listening to would walk past your studio. And you could go and talk to them and you're just like, wow, this is amazing. And so I was always allowed that freedom. And our boss at Capital Disney was just amazing to give us that. And then when that finally got G-capped, when GWR and Capital came together, they closed a load of the stations down, and that sadly was one of them. And our boss moved it over to the BBC in Cambridgeshire, and he said, "Oh, would you like to cover a couple of shows?" And I ended up just doing some cover shifts there for a couple of years, which was, again, you allowed us a certain amount of freedom, which was brilliant. And then, so I'd never really done format radio because I'd always been allowed that. Yeah. I was always trusted, you know. And then an opportunity at Heart came up, and it was a totally different ball game. And I take my hat off to anyone who can do that form of radio, because it's a real skill to be able to condense all that information into 5 seconds.
Yeah. Basically sort of told what to play, you're told what to say, when to say it, when to play it, all that kind of stuff. And you know, quite often you're playing music. You know, if you're into radio, I think you do have an interest in music and musical taste varies. But, you know, quite often you're playing music that you wouldn't necessarily pick yourself. That'd be fair to say, wouldn't it?
Yeah. And also, with the format as it was at the time at Heart, I'm not sure what it's like nowadays. They were lovely to, you know, they were lovely people. The guy running it was lovely. It was just very formatted. But also because they just started networking everything from Leicester Square, the shows that I were doing were across the UK, but that meant that you had to pre-record a lot of your links. So you had to say, "This is London's Heart," or "This is Birmingham's Heart," "This is Scotland's Heart," and so in the end, you weren't doing much live radio. Everything was pre-recorded, and you were just playing out your links to make it sound live. And I was sort of standing there going, "This isn't like radio, how I used to do. I loved doing radio, but this isn't the kind of radio that suited me." And I you know, it obviously works, you know, but it just was something that didn't necessarily suit the world. So I sort of fell out of love with it a little bit as everything got more formulaic.
The live element is
BBC
just
might be the way forward. But, you know, then I got taken off in a completely different direction. Maybe one day.
Maybe one day. Who knows? You know, Arsenal Radio might, start up as the club have to think of new ways to generate content and revenue, and who knows. Let's talk a little bit of football then. And you have a fantastic job working with the club, doing a lot of the content. And, you know, as I mentioned to you sort of off air, professional broadcasters and people who do the kind of work that you do might get a gig at a football club somewhere, and it may not necessarily be the football club that they support, but, you know, they do a professional job and they're there to host the shows and everything else. But you are an Arsenal fan at the heart of it, so that must make it even more exciting.
I pinch myself all the time. A lot of people on Twitter always send me messages going, do you know you've got the best job in the world? And I'm like, you don't need to tell me that. I regularly pinch myself, and I have a floor manager who I work with on a match day. And before every kickoff, we sit in those seats and we just go to look around, take it all in and just pinch yourself and really appreciate how fortunate we are to be sat here watching this team and in this stadium, and then what we get to do at pre-match and halftime. And, you know, I'm remembering that at the moment because I do remember that most recent game. And there was so much uncertainty about, would that be the last game this season? Would it not be the last game this season? And sort of, I keep flashing back to that day. And that halftime interview with Robert Pires, who is one of my favourite players to interview. He's just such a lovely, lovely man and such a legend, always gets an amazing reception. And I kind of think back to that halftime and go, wow, Is that the last one we'll do this season? I don't know. You know, who knows?
So tell me, what's like a typical match day at home, you know, where you're, you know, coming to the stadium? I mean, how much preparation goes in during the week to what's going to happen at halftime? And what's the day like itself?
Well, we get a running order and a rough script, I would say, sent through either 2 days before or the day before. Now, that's in terms of what VTs we're going to show, which highlights packages we're going to show, and any presentations that we might have, Player of the Month presentations, who is going to be joining us, who's the competition winner for that Player of the Month, if there's an Arsenal in the Community presentation. So all of that is listed. I mean, it is a huge operation, but the trick is to make it feel as though it's just sort of just happening, you know. But the amount of work and the prep that goes into the running order and the scripts and stuff like that is incredible. So normally I get to know who I'm interviewing maybe about 2 or 3 weeks ahead of the game, and then I will research that person and come up with what I think are maybe 10 between 8 and 10 questions that I think, as a fan, what would I like to hear about from this legend. And then I submit the questions to Arsenal, and then they send them off to the player or the player's agent and all that kind of stuff, just so that everything gets approved. The difference about the job that I do in terms of interviewing is I'm not trying to make headlines. You know, it's all about giving the legend the best experience on a match day. They're an invited guest. They get to watch the match in the director's box. So as a little bonus, they come out and wave to the crowd at halftime. We do a little chat and talk about their happy memories. So it's a really nice, for me, it's lovely to go down memory lane with them. And, but also quite hard, because you've got to, with some of them, they've had the most amazing careers, and you've got 3.5 minutes to cover it.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about this because, you know, obviously I've seen you do it, you know, at the stadium many times. And it must be a really weird dynamic, because normally if you're standing there and you've got a microphone and you're about to interview somebody, you expect in any other sort of context, all the attention to be on you and your guest. So people might fall silent. If you're doing it in a conference room, for example, you know, people are going to fall silent. But you have this really difficult dynamic to deal with, which is that in a crowd of 60,000 people, maybe 30,000 or 40,000 of them have buggered off at halftime to, like, have a pint or go to the bathroom or to get a pie or just to get a bit of fresh air or to hang out in the concourse or whatever it is. And then other people are there and they're going, wow, look, half the people are gone. I'll see if my Twitter's working now. So I'll check my Twitter. And they're checking and they're chatting to their mates and everything else. So it must be quite a challenging environment in which to do the interviews, because, you know, there are going to be people who are obviously interested in the guest and in what you're saying, but you're also having to deal with this, I don't mean to say like disinterest, but there's like a big part of it is people who aren't necessarily paying attention the way that they would were it happening anywhere else in any other environment or theatre or whatever it might be.
Yeah, I would agree with that. And I think the thing is, it's as you will know from using a radio analogy, and I always think of this when I'm presenting at Emirates, and people often say, do you ever get nervous about presenting in front of 60,000 people? And I say, well, firstly, no, because they're not there to see me. You know? So I'm the kind of the lucky guy who is the link man between me, between them and their legend or their halftime guest. So I'm just sort of the guy who links those two things together. You haven't paid your money to come and see me. So the pressure's off in some ways. But also, you know, in radio, we were always taught there is only ever one person watching. So you've got to make a connection with one person. Now, in a crowd of 60,000 people, if you can connect with one person, 30,000 people, 60,000 people, then that's, you know, someone somewhere is paying attention. And I think that's very, so I always treat it like that. When I'm looking down the camera, I always try and use words like you, And things like to make it sort of as though it's a personal thing rather than hello, everyone. You know, I always try and say hello to you so that it's trying to make that connection one-on-one.
Yeah, yeah.
And then people can dip in and dip out. And I think depending on who the legend is or who the guest is at halftime, it's some people might not know of that person because that person might have played before they took an interest in Arsenal. And some people might go, oh, I'm not interested in that. That's why I'm going to go and see my mates. But I have had some feedback before where people have said, you know, I never heard of that player, but it was really nice to hear about football in the 1950s and 1960s.
Sure.
And so we stayed and watched that. So I think it's, you know, it's one of those things where, as you know, Andrew, working in this game, you can't please everyone.
That's true.
And I've learned that over 25 years of doing this job. Not everyone's going to enjoy what you do.
Yeah.
Those are the facts, you know, and especially now with Twitter, people can pretty
can
quickly
tell you
what so you just have to go, do you know what? I can't please everyone. If someone out there has enjoyed what we've done at halftime, that's great.
Yeah.
And I have to say, over the years, I love working with Arsenal fans. They've been very, very good to me. And, you know, the feedback is always, if I ask a question, 9 times out of 10, we get a cheer or, you know, in response to it. And especially with the junior gunner penalties, with some of the stuff that's happened with those over the years, some of the junior gunners have created some great comedy moments and the responses have been brilliant from the crowd. So, you know, it's really nice when those moments happen. One of my favorite moments was, when we had Dennis Bergkamp. And his statue had just been unveiled outside Emirates Stadium. And that was, I think, the one occasion where no one left to get a drink at halftime. And you could hear a pin drop inside Emirates Stadium. And that was pretty spine-tingling stuff. And everyone was hanging off every word Dennis said. And I'll tell you a funny story about that, because obviously we submit the questions, make sure Dennis is happy, make sure the club's happy, make sure Dennis's agent and Ajax, and so all of this kind of stuff. Yeah, all good to go. And so I get to the last question that's been approved by everyone. And then Dennis goes, I think I know what the next question is. And I'm going, oh God, there isn't a next question. I know what he's thinking I'm going to ask, but obviously because I think he's just started at Ajax or something like that, I thought we don't want to go there and rock any boats. So I thought he thinks I'm going to ask, would he ever come back to Arsenal? Now, there's so many people who might be angry if I ask that question. So I thought, but it's the fans would love to hear him say that. So I'm stalling. And he's going, I think I know what the next question's going to be. And I went, oh, shall I ask the next question? At which point 60,000 people go, yes, you know. And so I said, well, I don't think I need to ask the next question, Dennis, but I think you might have an answer to it. At which point he said, of course, I'd love to come back to Arsenal one day. And then it got a really big cheer. It was brilliant, brilliant, brilliant. And afterwards I thought, you know what, if anyone ever says you shouldn't have asked him that question, I can say I didn't.
I might have led him down the path towards the answer, but I never asked it. Sometimes the first half doesn't quite go as well as we might like, right?
Yeah.
Does that present a challenge to you in terms of what you do? Because you've got to come out and you've got to be upbeat, and you're obviously trying to, trying to keep things as professional and on even keel as possible. But, you know, sometimes the mood within the stadium might not be that great. Is that something that you kind of have to just shove to the back of your mind and just do it the way you would normally do it?
I always will I will adjust my tone accordingly, I think, because as a fan, the last thing I would want is, you know, someone coming out half time pretending everything's all right, going, hey, it's time for junior gunner penalties, you know. So I try and adjust my tone. Unfortunately, it hasn't happened that often at Emirates, you know, and when we have been 1-0 down or you know, not playing badly, sometimes we will just score before half time, and I'm sitting, you know, crouching down next to the fourth official, and I'm just going, oh, that's great, that changes everything. You know, that makes life a lot easier for me at halftime because everyone's upbeat. But on the odd occasion where we have been 1-0 down at halftime and we haven't been playing as well as we could have been playing, then, yeah, I think you just have to sort of come out and gauge your tone slightly. So in the halftime score announcement, I try and do that quite straight.
Mm-hmm.
And we have a rule. I'm probably giving away trade secrets now, but we will never announce the score at half time if we are losing. So we will only announce the score at half time if we're winning or drawing. And so my halftime mic check, as it's called, I will say the score at Emirates is whatever it is, and then give a little trail for who we've got coming up at halftime. And if we're losing, we won't ever say that. We'll just do the trail because you don't, you know, people know what the score is. And so you kind of don't want to, you don't want to say that. And then you just go into the interview and hope that that sort of takes people's mind off things for a little while. And sometimes that's happened, you know. Again, we can't do anything about what's happening on the pitch. So it's one of those things that what we do at halftime is there. And again, if you want to engage with it, then it's there for you to engage with. And we've had a couple of really nice moments with the junior gunner penalties where we have been sort of, you know, losing at half time and a junior gunner has done something. And it's almost the perfect way to break the ice, really, because then everyone gets behind the junior gunner. They cheer and, you know, it's that's a lovely moment. And then I always sort of say, well, fingers crossed for we can turn it around in the second half. And then the second half begins. And then I don't have to worry after that.
Yeah, your job is done.
Your job is done. But I hope that sort of comes. I always try and gauge the mood. And I'm very conscious of that because I'm a fan and I feel what everyone else is feeling, and I want us to win all the time. I want us to be doing well all the time. And yes, my life is a lot easier when we're winning. I try and gauge the mood slightly, but I would like to think that comes across, and that they don't just go, oh, there's that Wally going out and doing junior gunner penalties at half time, pretending everything's all right. You know?
I know you said you're not out to make headlines, right? And clearly when you have the access that you have to people within the club, you know, the interviews that you can do for the club channels and the podcasts and the TV shows and everything else, you know, it's great to be able to talk to the people involved, because they're people that any one of us would love to sit down and interview. But I think, you know, let's say if I were to do an interview with somebody and you were to do an interview with somebody, if I'm doing it for my, you know, independent channel and you're doing it for the official club outlets, whatever, the tone or the it'd be slightly different, you know, which isn't to say I'm going to try and nail somebody or anything like that. But sometimes, you know, there are difficult questions that you can't avoid, I'm sure, as somebody who's doing interviews about, let's say, a match or interviews about a period in history or an incident with a player. You know, is it sometimes difficult to ask the question in the right way, if that's the best way to put it? Because, it must be hard at times to try and find the exact right phrasing where you're dealing with an issue that needs an answer, but you've got to be sort of diplomatic because of the way or because of where it's going at, if that makes sense.
Yeah, I mean, with the stuff I do for the club, really, I don't have to. I'm not really put in that position that often. I don't do post-match interviews. And when I first started, you know, at the club, my role has changed so much over the years, and Arsenal have given me so many incredible opportunities to do what I'm doing now. But that was more when I first started. I was covering press conferences and doing those kind of post-match interviews. And so in those, I think you have to ask the questions in those instances, and you do have to think carefully about your wording. But nowadays, it's more with the legends. It's more of a reflection. So you know, you can talk about Lee Dixon scoring that amazing own goal without worrying that he's going to get angry about it.
Enough time has passed to be able to deal with that one. Just a couple of decades.
It's a funny thing to talk about. Or Perry Groves wearing ridiculously tight shorts back in the 80s. And that's the aspect of the job I really enjoy, because I'm rarely put in that position, and it's not expected of me to ask those questions. And so that's I really enjoy that, because I'm not a confrontational person anyway, and I love that aspect of the job, that I can where a lot of negativity, I mean a lot of sport questioning is negative, isn't it? You know, it's, well, why did that go wrong? And so it's nice that I feel lucky that I'm able to concentrate on the positive aspects of someone's career and try and lift the mood slightly. And I hope hopefully that's, you know, that's what comes across.
I mean, that's the thing, you know, when Arsenal win 2-0, and this is sort of an accusation that you see thrown around quite a lot in terms of, you know, fan media, where, you know, maybe there's more discussion or more debate after, a defeat. And I think that's natural because there's usually more to talk about because you're asking what went wrong, why did this happen, why didn't this happen, et cetera, et cetera. Whereas a routine 2-0 win, you're sort of going, well, okay, that's what I expected. Let's move on and play the next game. So I think by its very nature, you know, poor results or controversial results, if that's the right way to put it, or results which have a lot going on, spark a lot more debate.
And it's always the defenders or the goalkeepers. They always have a little joke about that. It's like, if we're winning, they don't want to talk to us. But if we're losing, we're the people who get dragged out to do the post-match interviews.
Yeah. So who down the years have been your favourite interviewees? Whether that's, you know, pitch side or in some of the programmes that you've done?
Well, Dennis, I mean, I always say Dennis for that moment because that was such an incredible moment with everyone hanging off his every word. And, you know, with what Dennis had done for the club and his stature as an Arsenal legend, it's always that question. Who's the best Arsenal player? Thierry Henry, Dennis Bergkamp. You know, it's always the one, isn't it? So Andrew, who's the best Arsenal player? Thierry Henry or Dennis Bergkamp? Go.
Dennis Bergkamp.
Okay. Why?
I love Thierry Henry and he obviously was an amazing player, but I just sort of liked the combination of technique, of longevity, with that little edge of nastiness that Dennis had, which kind of resonates with me. just because, you know, I kind of like that in a player, you know, and particularly when it's one as you know, someone who's... Look, there are players who've been very physical who you wouldn't necessarily say are the game's most intelligent players, but Bergkamp clearly was. That combination, I think, just does something for me. So
And Thierry, I think, would say, well, I wouldn't have scored as many goals if I hadn't been the Dennis.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
I know Wrighty feels like that as well. But so Dennis, I really love that moment. That's the only time I've worked with Dennis over the years, actually, was that moment, because obviously he's been elsewhere.
Sure.
One of the jobs that the club have given me in recent years, which I absolutely love, are the VIP experiences, the VIP legend experiences. And that involves Ray Parlour, Lee Dixon, Martin Keown, or David Seaman.
Right.
And that's a tour of Emirates Stadium. And I'm sort of the guy who goes around and does all the facts and then throws a few questions at the legend at various points on the tour. And the tour normally lasts about 2.5 hours. And then we go up to the Diamond Club and have lunch up there. And then each fan gets time with the legend at their table so they can sign anything and have more photos and things like that. And I love those experiences because with the halftime interviews, as I mentioned, you get 3.5 minutes, maybe 4 minutes. And to try and cover someone like David Seaman's career in 4 minutes, you spend a minute and a half talking about the save against Sheffield United because David loves that save.
Yeah.
Well, so once you've covered that, you've got someone in your ear going, right, two more questions. Like, I have one a minute, you know. Whereas with the VIP experiences, we get to learn so much about the legends on those tours, and I just love working with those guys. And every time we do one, we find out new stuff. You know, David Seaman still got his ponytail. Did you know that?
I didn't. Yeah, where, like, in a drawer or on his head? Is it actually still attached to him?
In a drawer. And that was on one of the tours. We started talking about his ponytail and how he ended up with his ponytail initially, and that's a great story in itself.
Do we have to go on one of the Legends tours to find that out?
Well, come on a Legends. Well,
okay,
where they'll start again. Well, come on the David Seaman Legends tour.
Right, one day.
He's brilliant, and he is such fun to work with. And on the last one we did, which was actually just the week before lockdown, was working with David on that Legends tour. I think it was the 14th of March or something like that. And I'd managed to find his school reports. And when we got to the press conference room on the tour, I sort of said, right, David, it wasn't always rosy though, was it? And, you know, read a few school reports from back in the day where he said that if football doesn't work out, then we really worried about David and what's going to happen to him.
Well, lucky for him.
And he was brilliant with that. And, you know, Lee Dixon is great when we visit the TV studio on the tour, because that's Lee's natural environment now. That's where he spends so much time. So the insight he can give to what happens as an analyst, don't call him a pundit, an analyst,
right,
on TV with the earpiece and all that kind of stuff, and how he's told to wind up Roy Keane all the time, and how he helps Wrighty out because Wrighty doesn't have an earpiece. So Lee Dixon is Wrighty's kind of... Basically, Lee Dixon is in control of Wrighty when you're watching them on ITV. That's the upshot of it.
Right.
And so, yeah, it's brilliant. I love those tours, and to get time with those legends is incredible. I've worked with Ray a lot over the years on the pre-season tours as well.
Sure.
So that's always an adventure.
Yes, I think that's fair to say. I saw Ray in America last summer, and yes, there were some stories. That's fair to say. Well, look, Nigel, you know, you were, and I hope you will be soon again, living the dream in terms of your job and what you're doing.
Thank
hopefully
you.
We
yeah.
can hopefully we'll see you back pitch side very soon, because that will mean that things are on the up and up for everybody, and I hope you know, clearly that happens sooner rather than later, even if our realistic view of that isn't quite as optimistic, but yeah. You know,
we'll see. I mean, as long as it's safe for everyone to be back, and yeah. You know, it's going to take a while. I think realistically it's going to take a while. I think the thing, I'm trying to live in the present as much as we can, and just sort of go, do you know what, it's not happening at the moment, and there's no point projecting forward too much because no one knows anything at the moment. So we just sort of wait and see what we hear, and I can't wait to get back there. You know, it's a dream, and I'm so grateful to Arsenal for giving me those opportunities over the years, and to represent them is a real honour. You know, I'm terrible at playing football, but to actually get to represent them on the pitch with a microphone is a real honour, and I'm very proud to do it. So, yeah, fingers crossed, we'll all be back soon.
Fingers crossed. Well, listen, great to talk to you. Really appreciate the time, and, you know, stay well, stay safe, and, you know, we'll see you back soon, I hope.
Thanks very much indeed. Yeah, come on, you Gunners.
Thank you very much indeed to Nigel. You can follow him on Twitter at Mr. Nigel Mitchell. That is at Mr. Nigel Mitchell, and hopefully we will see him microphone in hand standing pitch side at the Emirates with Arsenal 3 or 4 nil up at halftime on our way to a resounding victory over whoever the hell it might be. It doesn't matter anymore, does it? You beat anyone at this point just for a bit of football. We will see what happens over the weekend, if there are any developments in terms of the Premier League's plan. If there are, or if there are developments from an Arsenal point of view regarding anything, James and I will discuss them on Monday in the Arscast Extra. So please join us for that. Have yourselves, you know, whatever kind of weekend you can have. It's a bank holiday here in Ireland. I mean, they don't make any difference to anybody now at this point. But that's what it is. But whatever you do this weekend, stay safe, stay healthy. James and I will be here on Monday. The blog continues as normal, so if you fancy a morning read every single morning, I'm still writing something every single day, whether it's about Arsenal or not. So, you know, arsblog.com for that, arsblog.news for the news when there is some news. And I don't know what else to say other than thank you as ever. Thank you for listening. You know, share, subscribe, leave us a review. All those things might help pass a few minutes of your day as well. You know, I'm thinking of you here. I am, I promise. That's it. We'll leave it there. I'll catch you on the next one. Until then, cheers. Bye-bye.
Welcome back to Sky Sports News. Project Restart, the Premier League's plan to get football going again, was announced earlier today, and clubs are getting back to training but under strict guidelines. Those include testing for all players, disinfecting of footballs and kit. Cars must be parked 3 spaces apart. Players will also have to wear a snood or a mask at all times. Those masks can be medical masks or comedy masks, like a giant horse. There are to be no toilet breaks whatsoever, and certainly no spitting. Each player must leave their saliva in a receptacle at the front door, where it can be picked up on the way out. French kissing must be kept to an absolute minimum. The practice of ear flicking when somebody does something wrong in training is no longer allowed. However, players will be able to throw disinfected darts at the culprit's head. And very finally, and most importantly, the Premier League say players must only breathe when absolutely necessary. There is to be no excess breathing whatsoever. Violations of this rule could see points deductions. With these guidelines, the Premier League expect football could be back as soon as 2024.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.